I'm Stephanie Gleason, senior reporter for The Deal. Welcome back to Fresh Start, where we examine Chapter 11 issues and cases to find out whether bankruptcy really is a fresh start. Today, we're talking about liquidation with Ian Fredericks of Hilco Global. Ian joined Hilco in 2011 after working as a bankruptcy lawyer. He's worked with clients including Circuit City, Radio Shack, the Sports Authority, the Limited, Sims, and Filings Basement. Thank you so much for being here, Ian.
Thank you for having me, Stephanie.
Ian, I don't know what your view on it is, but to me, liquidation sales are one of the most notable and tangible ways most U.S. consumers experience the Chapter 11 filing of a company. And so I'm really excited to talk to you about it today. You know, shopping a liquidation sale is exciting, it's memorable, but it can be sad. And it reminded me of a story I did in 2014 about the Lowman's liquidation sale. It was on the Upper West Side, and I talked to a woman and quoted her in the story. I'll just share it quick. She said, first it was Daffy's, now it's Lowman's. Upper West Side resident Emma Whitmore said, the 93-year-old chain was one of the places to find great deals on Italian designers. I've been sentenced to a lifetime of TJ Maxx. So at the risk of sounding obvious, Ian, people and not just bankruptcy nerds care about this topic. So I was hoping we could start by just sort of in the most basic way, explaining the way a liquidation plays into a Chapter 11 case.
Sure. I agree. Even for us who are in the business of doing liquidations, it's typically with mixed emotions. You know, it's a tough time period for anybody. We usually come in and have days to meet with a company that's just been informed that they are going to liquidate. So I'm certainly sensitive from the consumer side, the employee side. It impacts a lot of people and their families. So how a liquidation fits in, I would say that the typical format of a retailer that is heading into or contemplating bankruptcy is they're able to identify, before they file, a group of stores that are underperforming, unprofitable, and have been that way for some time. And so the typical playbook would be to group those stores together and start a store closing sale on that subset of stores, you know, shortly before the bankruptcy or, you know, in conjunction with the filing of the bankruptcy. And to do that, more often than not, they hire a professional firm like Hilco to conduct and run that sale for them. And what that enables the company to do is to immediately start to turn assets into cash and have some excess cash at that point, potentially pay down some of the debt on the front end, and then get out of lease liabilities pretty quickly. So whenever that sale ends post-bankruptcy, the company will typically reject those leases, and any liabilities associated with those leases turn into general unsecured claims that they can deal with as part of the bankruptcy. Then what you have, and this is really goes back to the 2005 amendments to the bankruptcy code that Congress did, retailers are now are stuck with a very tight window. You essentially have the certainty that you can stay in your lease locations for a maximum of 210 days. And then beyond that 210 days, you typically need landlord, well, you do need landlord consent in order to stay. That gives you a period that lenders and everybody else back up from. So they essentially take 210 days. They say, how long will a liquidation in the stores and e-commerce and whatever retail platforms they have, how long would that take? Let's back that up. So let's say a typical liquidation sale, you know, might run somewhere between 60 to 90 days. They will back up from that 210, subtract the 60 to 90 days. So now you're at, you know, roughly a, call it 120 to 150 days. That's how much time the retailer then has in a bankruptcy to try to, you know, restructure, get consensus, and get all of those things. That's a tight window. And especially for a lot of constituents who didn't sort of find out, you know, the secured lenders usually know pretty far in advance that a bankruptcy is coming, and they're able to prepare for that. The vendors, the employees, a lot of the other constituents, they may think that a bankruptcy might be on the horizon because of things that are in the news, or just, you know, they recognize the company's not doing great. But when that happens, it's typically a big surprise. And so it takes them a while to just get up to speed. So that 120 to 150 days is not much time, which is why you see so many retailers liquidate. And then at that point in time, what the company usually tries to do is run a dual sale process. They'll usually try to market the business that's left. So subtract out those stores that we're going to close. The business that's left is a going concern. And at the same time, get liquidation bids. And then that way, if the going concern process is unsuccessful, they have a backup liquidation bid at that point in time. They can get it quickly approved by the court and quickly start and know that they have the benefit of the lease period for that 210 days. So that's typically how a liquidation works in bankruptcy.
I've noticed in the last few years that sometimes even it is such a tight timeline that sometimes even liquidation sales are starting like on the first day of the filing or even a few days before. Is that a trend you're seeing where retailers are trying to maximize the amount of time that they have and not delay starting the sales?
I think that's sort of a product of probably a couple of factors. One of them is usually retailers have been marketing themselves for some time, right? So you have an investment banker that's gone out to the market and tried to market the retailer and tried to, you know, sell it and has, you know, largely exhausted that process. And there's really nothing that can come from further marketing of the business as a going concern. You know, so that's sort of one factor. I would say another factor is how the lenders are feeling about the collateral package. So one of the things you saw during COVID, and ourselves included, COVID was unprecedented on so many levels. But from a standpoint of when the lockdown started to whenever the lockdown was going to end, there was tremendous uncertainty around how consumer behavior was going to be, right? You'd had this period between, call it mid-March and the end of May, roughly, where the consumer had really migrated to e-commerce sales, whether it was grocery or apparel that they might need. You had this migration. There were big questions around whether or not, you know, that migration was permanent or to what extent once things opened back up, the consumer would go back into the store. So there you had lenders that were essentially saying, okay, we are very uncomfortable about our collateral position. We're talking to the liquidation firms like Hilco, and they're uncertain around exactly what the consumer behavior is going to be and whether the value is going to be there in that collateral. And we're in a period where there hasn't been much investment by private equity firms or other sponsors to acquire retail. So we're anticipating that once things open back up and something can be liquidated, that we're just going to run a liquidation process. So that was one of the reasons why you saw a lot more last year come out of the gate liquidating. And then I would say the last reason why you see things sort of start and then go in, one of the dynamics that's happened over the last couple of years is landlords have become a lot more aggressive in state court and moving a lot more quickly. And Simon would probably be the most notable one, but they are going to state court. And a lot of times that state court they're going to is Indiana State Court, if it's Simon, because Simon's headquartered there. A lot of their leases have either exclusive or dual jurisdiction there. And so they run into Indiana State Court. It's a favorable forum for them. And they have now developed a track record of getting injunctions or temporary restraining orders. They've had success in enforcing continuous operations clauses. And you saw that start maybe out in Washington with a Whole Foods store at one point over the last couple of years, where Whole Foods decided not to open it. The landlord went to sue and said, no, you need to open this store. It was right around the time that Amazon acquired them and, you know, won a court decision that said, yep, you need to open this store. So with landlords getting a lot more aggressive, it's become more difficult to run any kind of a liquidation sale process outside of bankruptcy. So that's one of the reasons why you see it start either really close or right on the first day and not spread out. You know, they used to start maybe 30 days before a bankruptcy.
So I'm not familiar with these continuous operation clauses. And so it's basically saying that the retailer has to operate unless they file for bankruptcy?
No. So it doesn't have an exception for bankruptcy, but bankruptcy has the automatic stay. And then there are certain sections of 365, which is executory contracts and unexpired leases that make certain provisions of leases and contracts unenforceable while the company is in bankruptcy. A continuous operation clause is basically a clause that typically is in there for anchor tenants or department stores or things like that, that says you need to, you need to continuously operate some and keep your doors open and your stores stocked, because remember, those anchors or department stores are the draw that the other stores rely on in terms of generating business. So keeping those department stores and those anchors open is critical for a landlord. And up until, you know, the last couple of years, those continuous operations or opening clauses were not really enforced in court. You know, there was some kind of a settlement reached or something like that, but the landlords have recently tried to figure out ways to keep tenants, and that was one of them.
And that was happening during the COVID shutdown or after?
It actually started before the COVID shutdown. The COVID shutdown really negated that benefit because the federal government and a lot of the states put some provisions in place. And then you always have a force majeure clause in a lease where if there's some giant interruption or act of God, or I don't imagine many of them said pandemics, you know, those things happened, then somebody could be relieved from having to perform under a contract or lease. So when the imposed shutdown happened, nobody was running to court and saying, you have to open it back up.
It seems clear to me that just like so many other parts of bankruptcy, liquidation sales have changed a lot during the course of your career. I think we've talked about a few ways. I mean, are there other ways that you have noticed, you know, the way companies use this process in bankruptcy has changed?
I would say the most notable change, and it's really interesting. So if you go back to call it 2016, sort of 2016 and before, the majority of liquidations were conducted on what has been termed a guarantee or equity type transaction. And what that means is that typically an appraisal firm, when a lender is going to loan money to a, you know, a retail borrower, that lender gets an appraisal from a company like we have an appraisal group that does these at Hilco. They get an appraisal from somebody like Hilco. Hilco appraises the inventory and any other assets the lender wants us to, but more often than not, it's the inventory, and comes up with a net orderly liquidation value. That net orderly liquidation value is then used by the lender to determine how much they're going to loan the retailer on their revolving credit facility for inventory. And that, you know, they build a borrowing base, and then that borrowing base dictates it. One of the features of that appraisal is whether it's done on a quote fee or a guarantee basis. When it's done on a fee basis, the appraisal firm and then typically their liquidation affiliate is saying, we have confidence in these numbers, but we're not willing to put our capital there or say that we'll put our capital there if there's ultimately a liquidation down the road. On a guarantee basis, what the lender has is essentially something saying our affiliate liquidation firm is willing to stand behind these numbers, assuming things don't change drastically. And so in 2016 and before, more often than not, when a liquidation would happen, the lenders and all the other constituents in the cases asked for guarantee bids, where we would say, let's say the NOLB was 80% of cost. We would come in and say, okay, we're willing to bid 80% of cost. Then there would be an open auction, and the other liquidation firms would have the ability to bid, and whoever the initial bid was would have the ability to rebid. And then when bidding was done and it was approved by the court, the liquidator would pay the money to the company or to its lender that it had guaranteed. And so that way the lender got paid off quickly and was essentially out of the case. What you saw beginning in 2017, there had been enough stability in liquidation values over the years that the company and its advisors decided that they, you know, when companies were in bankruptcy, themselves and their advisors decided that they would prefer a fee outcome where the liquidator comes in and gets hired on a fee. The lender then is taking all of the risk on the liquidation results. It's not shifting to the liquidator like in a guarantee transaction. That trend continued right up to COVID. And at COVID, all of a sudden, the lenders were saying, hey, we want guarantee bids now, you know, and we were saying, time out. This is unprecedented. We're not willing to give guarantee bids. You know, we have nobody has any idea what's going to happen. And so fee transactions continued for a period. And then towards the end of last year, we started going back and issuing some guarantees. Whether that trend continues or not remains to be seen. I think lenders realized we had the benefit of this guarantee appraisal, and we didn't use it for so long that when we all of a sudden needed it, they essentially couldn't go get it because they had ignored it for so long. I mean, it had basically been 4 years. So we'll see if that trend reverses.
So basically, when it changed in 2017, was there a specific case or like something that spurred this change, or just lenders deciding like, oh, if we bear more of this risk, then I'm assuming that they are seeing greater rewards if they're seeing more risk. Was that the thinking in 2017?
So the lenders don't see any greater reward. They may get to charge interest a little bit more, but typically they don't see a greater reward. It wasn't really the lenders that were forcing this result. It was the company and its advisors who were looking at it and saying, the results have been so predictable for so many years. Why don't we, the company, for the benefit of all of our creditors, capture any upside to the net orderly liquidation values? And the lenders went along. They wouldn't disagree. They wouldn't object. They certainly had the right to force, and in some instances, some rare instances, did force auctions and guarantee proposals. But that was ones where maybe everybody felt a little bit less comfortable. But the lenders don't really get much benefit to not shifting the risk.
And then last year, obviously, everything is in chaos. There's uncertainty, and they start asking again for these guarantee bids.
Yep.
Did they get them in a few cases, you said?
There were a few cases where we gave guarantee bids. What we were doing here at Hilco was we were essentially monitoring consumer behavior once things started to open up on a daily basis. And we were digging in at the state, the city, country level. We had transactions going all over the United States, Canada, and Australia. And we were essentially monitoring everything by the day. By doing that, we were able to start to see trends, and where we would start to see trends that we felt gave us more insight into predictable consumer behavior, we would then look at it and say, okay, we're willing to issue a guarantee here. One of the things that was also unique about last year was you had a situation where the supply chains got massively disrupted. The factory shut down overseas, ports, everything started causing supply chain issues. And neither lenders nor retailers were really ordering goods to prepare for the upcoming seasons. And in fact, many retailers were calling us and saying, I want to get out of my entire spring mix, right? Will you come and buy, pick up from my stores, all of the inventory that's in the stores? Because I have summer goods coming. They're already ordered. I don't know exactly when they're going to get here, but I need to reset my stores for summer. Not many retailers actually ended up executing on that because the values were low. But one of the things that we did was where you had these liquidations, you had gaps in the inventory, or you had seasonably lower recovering inventory. So when you typically come out of winter, you will set for spring and your winter will go on clearance. If you don't have spring and you can't move that winter clearance and things open up in the summer, now you have some spring goods, you have the winter clearance that didn't move, but you really need summer goods, which are sometimes close to spring, depending on the retailer. What we did was went out on our own risk and on our own balance sheet and bought what we call supplemental inventory to fill in those gaps. So that was an area where we were willing to take considerable risk. And I would say, you know, we probably bought across our various projects that we ran all of last year, several hundred million dollars of cost inventory to bring into these sales. Sometimes we would go to the company's existing vendors because the lenders were saying, I'm not loaning any more money here. I want it liquidated. And we're saying, if you liquidate with just the inventory that's in there, your recovery is going to be low. Let us round out the assortment. Let us go to the company's vendors. Let us bring stuff in. That's going to overall boost the result for you on your inventory. And then we would share the benefit of selling that additional inventory with the company and its creditors. And so that was an area where we assumed a ton of risk. It's not an exact guarantee, but it was an area where we took on several hundred million dollars of risk.
And so you were buying like between season inventory and then liquidating it in those retailers' stores, or did you have other, how did that work?
So it was a combination of the retailer's existing vendor pool. So think of a Pier 1 Imports, which was a transaction that we worked on. You had an existing vendor pool that had inventory that was supposed to be coming in. The lender didn't want to buy that inventory. They didn't want to take the risk on it. We purchased the inventory, and then we also went out to the market and supplemented. So we looked at it and said, okay, Pier 1 has a bunch of furniture coming in, but Pier 1 also sells flatware and glassware and things like that. That stuff is not coming in. The company, you know, for whatever reason, there are shortages in the supply chain. Where can we source that inventory and bring it in as supplemental inventory so that when a consumer comes in, they still look at it and see a full Pier 1 store and they have the broad assortment that they want and they're still able to buy things, you know, at deep discounts, even those supplemental inventory that we bring in.
And so, you know, here we are in 2021, retail has come back to people are shopping again in person. It's not only online, but I know supply chain issues continue to be at the forefront of many retailers' minds. Can you talk a little bit about the outlook for retailers based in this current environment?
Sure. So one of the interesting things about this year is that if you look at public companies and some of the data that comes out of the various government agencies, at first glance, everything looks like it's going really well. Retail is rebounded and sales and margin are up and consumers are going out and they're shopping, et cetera. When you dig deeper, what you realize actually is things are up relative to 2020. And that would make sense because 2020 was so disruptive. But when you dig deeper and look back at 2019, the comps to 2019 are not necessarily there. And some retailers are still probably down on a top line sales basis, as much as 20% or more up against their 2019 numbers. But I would say very few that were drastically down in 2020 have returned to their 2019 base case. Where we are seeing improvement pretty much across retail is in the gross margin area. And part of the reason for that is the supply chain disruption that is happening. What sort of started back in March and was there a little bit got exacerbated with the Suez Canal situation. Even though it only lasted about 2 weeks, the supply chains really operate on a real-time basis. And so a two-week disruption causes all kinds of delays because those ships that were delayed were supposed to be in port 2 weeks earlier. Those containers that were on those ships were designated to be in port then. And then all those things were going in different places, you know, over a period of time. So that two-week disruption, you have labor disruptions, you have shutdowns in other countries where warehouses or manufacturing is shut down. You know, so you couple all of the challenges that have been happening. And what that means is that retailers aren't getting the inventory that they either ordered or thought they were going to get at the time that they thought they were going to get it. So what they've been doing is not discounting as much for the consumer. As a result of not discounting as much, your gross margin improves, but you're not able to necessarily sell as much inventory to meet your sales goals. So that has had an impact. One of the benefits of COVID on retail was it really forced just about every company to take a really hard look at their overhead and SG&A and decide, do I really need the infrastructure that I've built, or what kind of thinned out infrastructure can I actually live with? So most retailers have also seen success in cutting that overhead cost and not necessarily bringing back all of the people that once worked there, or closing certain locations, or going to a remote only environment and saving costs there. So there, a lot of cost savings has again helped with that sales miss. When you couple the cost savings with an improved gross margin, you can make up some of that sales miss. What's going to be interesting is that only lasts for so long, the gross margin improvement, if all your costs of goods sold are increasing. So with supply chain disruption, there's been increased costs. I think the cost of a container on average is probably about 3 times what it was pre-pandemic. There have been labor shortages, which has forced up wage growth, which overall is a good thing, but you still have labor shortages. You have people that don't want to come back into warehouses and distribution centers. That's slowing down even when inventory is received, how quickly it's received, how quickly it's pushed out to stores. And then the one other piece is we have seen inflation. Depending on who you read, will tell you whether or not inflation is temporary or more permanent. But with that inflation, it certainly caused increase in pricing. Whether that pricing is able to be passed on to the consumer is an open question. So I don't see a lot of that having an impact in, call it, the next couple of months. But as you move into the fourth quarter, if retailers don't have the inventory that they need to generate that all-important fourth quarter sales bump, that's going to be a big hit, and see who can recover, or, you know, who can withstand that. And I think one of the ways retailers will do it is, again, you're going to see Black Friday deals. There are always Black Friday deals. Will those Black Friday deals be as deep and as broad as they typically would be? I would tell you probably not. And will retailers discount a lot going into Christmas as they have historically? I'd tell you probably less. So that's kind of the, you know, short-term outlook as I see it.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like a little bit of a perfect storm going into the all-important holiday season. No workers, supply chain issues, inflation.
You said it better than I did.
But I guess we'll see what happens. It does sound like it will be an interesting holiday season. Are there other lessons from COVID that you have taken for your business?
Yes, definitely. One of the things that we've done here, and I would say we were pretty fortunate that we started this probably about 9 months before COVID, that we didn't have a crystal ball. It was really just luck, but we really moved over to and really started taking a hard look at, you know, ways to improve what we do through the use of technology, and also ways to help those employees who are displaced by liquidation sales find their next job, and also provide them with some tools to improve their chances of getting that next job. So we developed initially for ourselves a proprietary piece of technology that would help improve our store operations. So when we run a liquidation sale, we typically leverage the existing store teams that are in place. So they stay the employees of the retailer and they work throughout the liquidation sale. What we typically overlay is a team of what we call field supervisors. They're akin to a regional or district manager. So unless the stores are really big, like take one of the giant home improvement stores, you know, you would have maybe one supervisor per store, because there's so much inventory in that store and such a large space that sometimes you'll have one supervisor for that store. But more often than not, a supervisor has responsibility for a group of stores that can range from 2 to maybe up to 15 for really small apparel retailers. One of the challenges with doing that is, especially you get into supervisors having responsibility for more stores, it's not possible for them to be in every store every day. So we wanted to create technology that would improve their ability to communicate with the store staff, communicate amongst one another, allow our corporate team to have more real-time visibility into what's going on in all of the stores. And so we created that for ourselves. As we started using it on projects, especially during COVID, we realized from other retailers were asking us, hey, if this works for you, it works for us. And so turning that technology into something that can improve all retail is something that we're doing. And we're really building on a move towards technology that we are otherwise making. We see it as even more important now with COVID than it was before. And then on the employee side, one of the things that we did was we developed something that would basically be an incentive for the store employees to stick with the liquidation sale and really see it through to the end and try to achieve the best result. We created something where it has job boards for them. It has resume building tools, cover letter building tools, but then it has this thing called a letter of recommendation. And it's a fairly standard letter of recommendation that says this employee was displaced through no fault of their own. They worked through a very difficult situation. They performed all of their tasks and they performed them well. And we give that to those employees that stick around, or the company does actually give it to those employees that stick around. And that has multiple benefits for them. They can take that to the next employer who asks the question, why did you get laid off from this retailer? And they can point to that. It also helps them with unemployment claims to prove that they actually weren't fired. They were just, you know, let go through no fault of their own. So,
right. Yeah. I imagine that keeping employees through the end of a liquidation sale is a constant challenge. One of the things I've heard during my time covering bankruptcy is the idea that liquidators have become really good at their jobs and gotten better and better at being efficient in liquidation sales. It sounds like from everything you've said that that is very true, but that maybe sometimes it causes companies to wind up in liquidation or lenders to push for a liquidation when maybe otherwise they've had a chance at a going concern restructuring. Is that something that you think happens, or that most of the time when a company winds up in liquidation, it's because it just isn't necessarily needed anymore?
Yeah, it's an interesting and great question. And I'm sure depending on who you ask, you'll get different answers. I would tell you that liquidators have always been really good and efficient. If you go back to before those 2005 amendments, the results that were being achieved then and the results after the 2005 amendments, et cetera, there have been very few instances where lenders actually took losses on their loans, or if they did, they were relatively small. What I would say the biggest reasons why retailers end up liquidating in an 11 is really around those amendments to the bankruptcy code. Amendments to the bankruptcy code, and it's a very different capital structure than ever existed in retail. And I'll walk you through both of those and show you the stark contrast between, and they both happened around the same time where the capital structure was changing and the bankruptcy code changed. So call it the mid-2000s, so around 2005. Before that, you have a typical retail capital structure consisted of an asset-based loan from one of the big banks, call it a Wells Fargo, a Bank of America. At that time, GE was in this space as well. And they would have a revolving credit facility. They would get that appraisal that I mentioned earlier, and they'd loan against the NOLV in that appraisal. And that was the sole secured lender. Then you would essentially have trade credit, other types of employee claims, things like that, and then the equity. Because of that, the company had the ability to sometimes try to borrow money from others against other assets that that secured lender was not lending against and potentially reorganize. They also had a lot of time. So they could really see, and they could use a bankruptcy to restructure the business, make improvements and things like that, because they could consistently get extensions of what's called the 365 D4 deadline. And they would typically go in 60 or 90 year day extensions where they were routinely granted by the court. And it was very difficult for the landlords to get them to stop those extensions. So a retail bankruptcy could last a year, it could last 2 years. And that gave the ability for a company to reorganize. If the company was saleable and somebody wanted to buy it, somebody could also come in, but they could actually effectuate a Chapter 11 reorganization plan, come out the other side and try to improve the business. 2005 switched that. It made it a 210 hard stop and switch the leverage to landlords. When you couple that with kind of the rise of private equity were looking at ways to try to loan or buy retail, grow retail, loan additional money to retail to support that growth. And so you started seeing a change in the capital structure where you'd have an asset-based loan by a Wells or a Bank of America or somebody like that. And then you would see a term loan. There would be a gap between the revolver and the term loan because the bank would not advance up to 100% of the NOLV. They might advance at that point in time 80% of the NOLV. So you had this built-in gap. Fast forward several more years, and now somebody figured out that we can actually fill that gap with something that's called a FILO, which means a first-in, last-out loan. Those FILO loans slip into the back end of that revolving credit facility, so they fill the gap between the term loan and the ABL. And now you have essentially the entire company and all of its assets fully leveraged, right? The company has no ability then, as you sort of move beyond 2008 and into this decade, or I guess it was the last decade now, the 20s, the roaring 20s.
Yes.
As you move into that decade, e-commerce and digital is exploding. Well, if you're highly levered and there's a massive shift in consumer behavior, you have no ability to access the capital markets or otherwise get capital to grow your business. And so that's why the shift by most retailers to a really dynamic digital or e-commerce business has been so slow, and why they were still so reliant on stores. They built an infrastructure around that, and then they lacked the capital to be able to implement that growth. So I would say those three factors, liquidators, getting the results that were in those appraisals, the changes in the bankruptcy code, and then the leverage that is put on retail you know, have led to more often than not retailers liquidating. We have no ability as liquidators to put the pressure on companies to liquidate. The timing of when it happens really comes from that 210-day period.
And I have been interested to ask you as well, I understand that Hilco is serving as a lender sometimes. Can you talk to me a little bit about Hilco as a lender?
Sure. So we created a separate business line. We call it Restore Capital. And essentially what it allows us to do is provide extra capital to retail businesses that we think they need a lifeline to survive, or they want to grow the business or something else. The lending community has a range of what they're willing to lend at. Sometimes we look at appraisals that are out there and say, you know what, that appraisal by, you know, another firm is actually undervalued the inventory or undervalued some other assets. And because we have expertise in-house across just about every asset category, we can go be more aggressive on that. So we will come in and provide what we call a last out financing. So everybody that's in there in the capital structure stays where they are from a secured standpoint. And we will sit as a last out piece of all those secured loans. We'll provide the company with the additional capital they need to execute a growth strategy or get through a rocky time period and hopefully come out the other end. So it's really the last way for a retailer or consumer goods company, or really any business, to leverage their assets to get the additional capital they need. We've had success both ways. Sometimes it's resulted in a liquidation, but so far many of our loans have actually been paid back and the retailer's gone on and found new life by being able to execute their growth strategy.
And so these tend to be distressed situations that you're lending into, obviously.
Not only. Right now, we're working on M&A transactions where you have a buyer coming in and looking to raise capital to make an acquisition. And it's a healthy business that they're acquiring. Just because we have so much expertise in the ultimate asset value, it's just a different way for us to put capital to work where we feel very comfortable with the asset value and stretch further than more traditional lenders might.
And I wanted to ask you about the Aeropostale deal. I know Hilco was involved and you were involved. I think it's really interesting. You haven't seen a lot of Chapter 11 cases go the way where it's a consortium of people that include a liquidation firm that are actually saving a company from liquidation and ultimately like reopened stores. I mean, can you explain a little bit about the way that deal worked?
Yeah, sure. It's really interesting because the story that got put into the media was different than the way that it actually played out. When we originally submitted a proposal with an intellectual property buyer, it was Authentic Brands Group.
Yeah.
You know, Authentic Brands wanted to own the intellectual property. They do best from a brand management and licensing standpoint if there is an existing store footprint, but they are not store operators. And so typically they try to partner with an operator who would want a subset of the stores, and then we would partner with them to liquidate the stuff that the go forward business doesn't want. In Aeropostale, there were some people who kicked the tires but couldn't get there. And so ultimately, Authentic Brands still wanted to own the intellectual property. So we submitted a joint bid with them. One of the constituents that was just very desperate at that point in time to save the stores, because it was such a big swath of stores, were the two landlords, Simon and General Growth Properties, now Brookfield Properties. And we essentially went to the investment bankers for the business and said, we think that there could be a solution here if Simon and Brookfield are willing to give lease concessions and potentially take a subset of the management team, because we thought they had a good core management team to take this business forward. But it's either going to take a lot of capital or they're going to have to allow us to liquidate inventory and we'll supplement with that capital. And the investment banker was an interesting call because he was sort of shocked. He goes, so what you're telling me is that a group of liquidators, an intellectual property buyer, and landlords are going to save the company. And my colleague, Ben Nortman, you know, who's our CEO, said, yep, that's exactly what I'm telling you. And, it took 2 weeks in conference rooms. I didn't sleep for most of that, trying to put a deal together that worked for everybody. you know, then trying to document the deal was that much more challenging because it had never been done before. And I was a big part of getting the structure together that would work and ultimately getting the thing over the finish line. It has since been a very successful model for at least Simon Property Group. They do it regularly with Authentic Brands with us.
With Brooks Brothers and a few others.
Forever 21. They did it with Bucky Brands, which was unfortunately one of the businesses that we were supporting, and out of court, not distressed restructuring, but a restructuring of the business. We supported them with a loan, but for COVID, they were on a really good track to actually achieve the restructuring, but COVID threw a massive monkey wrench in that one.
They're not alone.
You know, so it's proven to be a very successful model. They created a new business called Spark, which is a joint venture of Authentic Brands and Simon Property Group. We were actually a small owner in that at one point as well. So while liquidation is our core business, you have, at least here at Hilco, a group of former restructuring professionals. I was a restructuring lawyer at Skadden Arps. Ben Nortman, our CEO, was a restructuring lawyer at Jones Day. Liquidation is just one tool in the toolbox, and it should only be the result if there's no other solution. We really try to look for ways to save companies, save the employees, things like that. And if all else fails, we certainly have the capabilities and the expertise to be there to get the best result for creditors. So,
and so in the Aeropostale deal, you were part owners of the company at the end, right?
Correct. We were part owner of the OpCo. At that point in time, it wasn't called Spark. We were part owners of the intellectual property company. You know, ABG was a majority owner of that. And then Simon, Brookfield, and us, and at the time, our partner, Gordon Brothers, we were all initial equity holders. We still are equity holders in Authentic Brands Group, very small equity holders. We ultimately got bought out of our piece of Spark. But it's, again, it's proven to be a successful model. We've replicated it elsewhere in other ways. So it's worked out well.
Definitely a very creative solution. I remember starting to see partnerships coming through and thinking, like, wow, that's, I wouldn't have guessed that, but it makes sense when you think about it logically.
Yeah. You know, look, the goal's always been to get the highest value and best recovery for creditors. And that's what we do. And we have a lot of tools in the toolbox.
And, you know, obviously there are a lot of joint venture liquidation bids that I notice as well, where Hilco teams with some of the other firms. How did that come about, and why are you guys teaming up so frequently these days?
Sure. So there's a couple reasons for it. How it came about far predates me. I would tell you it was probably born out of the lending syndication. So the original lenders to retailers actually started at liquidation firms. So the whole concept of a asset-based loan and loaning against assets and that certainty actually started with some of the liquidation firms going back over 30 years. And then ultimately those businesses were acquired by some of the banks in Boston that were ultimately rolled up into the bigger banks. But that's why so much retail comes out of Boston, was because the couple of liquidation firms that did retail back in the 80s and early 90s developed lending businesses. Those lending businesses were ultimately acquired. And then banks regularly syndicate their loans to defray risk. So I think that's one of the main reasons that liquidation firms joint venture, is to defray risk. That's one piece. The other piece is we have these pools of supervisors. Those supervisors are accustomed to working on like a project basis, but they're not full-time employees and they typically don't work for an entire year. So we need those pools for all the liquidation projects. When you joint venture, you're able to access a larger pool, get better overall supervisors from the two pools with expertise in that particular area, and put them to work on project. If you're not able to do that, then the next project that comes up will have less availability of really quality supervisors and less people willing to bid on a particular project. So if you have a situation where we believe we have the largest pool of supervisors in the industry, somewhere between 200 and 250. Well, last year, as an example, you needed twice that amount and we were leveraging up if we were going to do everything on our own. So we did more joint ventures to try to share supervisor pools. And I would say the last piece of it is that, as I talked about earlier, we use data to try to determine consumer behavior going forward to be able to be predictive in both the appraisals, because we peer review our sister firm's appraisals. So we want to be able to have as many what our former CEO and current chairman called weather balloons in the air. The more deals you have operating at a particular time, the more you're able to predict consumer behavior across different categories. By being able to predict more consumer behavior, we're able to bid more ultimately in a liquidation sale or get a better result because we're able to leverage that experience. So those are the three main reasons. It's defraying risk. It's that human capital that you need, the resources in the field that really execute the transaction and getting the best pool of supervisors on a transaction, and then having as many weather balloons in the air to be able to understand consumer behavior. That's the three main reasons why you see joint ventures.
One of the main things that you think about is that, like, liquidation is not usually considered something that's like a positive outcome for a business. They try to avoid it. But from our conversation today, I've really taken away that there are aspects of it that can be positive for a lot of other people who are involved, and that sometimes it is necessary. How do you view a business that is in liquidation and that outcome?
Sure. It's a great question. And I would say the initial reaction from anybody from a liquidation is pretty negative, right? Sometimes it's a storied business or storied brand that has been around for decades. And a lot of people have vested not necessarily money, but a lot of their time, either as an employee or as a vendor or just as a customer with that brand. You know, there's a lot of brand loyalty that goes along with it. One of the things that a liquidation allows is, one, it allows the consumer in particular, and oftentimes the company's employees, to buy goods that they love at discounts that would otherwise not be available. So once people get over the initial heartbreak or the negative feelings about it, that is one benefit that everybody gets from it, is you can buy stuff at prices you otherwise would not be able to buy. The next benefit is, and you're seeing this a lot with the intellectual property, a lot of really smart people, especially in the digital and commerce area, have a vision for what a brand could be operated differently. And so it really gives the opportunity for that brand to continue to exist, but in a different way, and in a way that's more sustainable and potentially profitable. That to me is a huge benefit. It's a fresh look at something that obviously wasn't working for one reason or another, and not necessarily through anybody's fault, but it's just a fresh look at things. Those fresh eyes, a lot of times those people are a generation below me at least, but they're a younger generation that just looks at the world differently. And the population's changing, the makeup of the population is changing. And just because something worked in the past doesn't mean it's going to continue to work forever. Having that fresh set of eyes and revitalizing the brand in a way where the existing customer can get what they want from it, but you can open it up to a whole set of new customers who maybe weren't familiar with it or want to interact with it in a different way. Those are the big positives, you know, I see from it once you get through that initial response period.
Yeah, definitely. Well, Ian, I really enjoyed getting to talk to you today, and I really appreciate you coming on the podcast.
I really appreciate you inviting me. We probably went in some directions that we weren't anticipating at the beginning, but I really enjoyed the conversation, and I'm very grateful for being a part of it. So thank you so much.
This is Stephanie Gleason, and you are listening to Fresh Start.